It's Lars. Thank you for checking out my podcast, and have a great day.
Lord.
Together, we can forge a new beginning for America.
The 45th President of the United States, Donald J. Trump.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
And yes, together, we will make America great again. Thank you, God bless you, and God bless America.
Now, honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It is a pleasure to be with you on a Conspiracy Theory Thursday night. I'm glad to take your calls as well at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. We're learning more and more about what is in the Senate side of Obamacare repeal. And no, it does not repeal Obamacare fully. It doesn't go nearly far enough. But can we even get this far? That's a question yet to be determined. We'll talk about that tonight. An L.A. teen is dead after police were called to a house party noise complaint early this morning. But wait till you hear the whole story and how it happened. I actually feel for the officers who were involved in this. It was not their fault. The Obamacare repeal bill was released today. It plans to make deep cuts to Medicaid, and states are going to be allowed to waive insurance regulations. But will it gain enough support from conservatives? So far, it is at least a couple of votes short, even in the Republican majority Senate. Is national reciprocity for concealed carry close to passing as congressional support grows? Well, after the incident last week involving Congressman Steve Scalise and others who were shot, I would hope that at some point you could take your concealed carry permit from any state in America, travel to another state, and not have to worry about whether or not your permit is any good. And legendary broadcaster Lou Dobbs joins me later on to talk about his new book, Putin's Gambit. It almost sounds like a book that could have been written in the last 6 months involving the Trump administration, but it wasn't. It was written a couple of years ago, and it's taken that long to get through the process to become a published book. Plus, boys are wearing skirts to school to make a point. Wait till you hear why. And make sure to cast a vote in my quick poll. We put up a brand new question every night at LarsLarson.com. Tonight's question is inspired by something that President Trump announced in a speech last night in Iowa. He was taking a bit of a victory lap after the big wins in two special elections in which Republicans won and Democrats lost. And actually, that was the right result as well. Donald Trump said he will soon push for legislation that says immigrants to America should not receive any welfare benefits for at least 5 years. I think that's a reasonable restriction, don't you? If somebody is going to come to America and wants to immigrate to this country, the most generous country when it comes to immigration of any country on earth that you'd want to live in, shouldn't you be prepared to support yourself rather than coming here to simply be on the dole? The measure would stipulate that those seeking admission to our country must be able to support themselves financially and should not be able to use welfare for at least a period of 5 years. Now, that even allows that somebody might come here fully intending to support himself or herself, work for a few years, and then because of changes in the marketplace or unforeseen consequences, might be forced to go on some kind of social welfare program. But not for at least 5 years. Come here intending to support yourself, or don't come here at all, as far as I'm concerned. I would say yes. Immigrants to America should not get welfare. No, they should not. And we should put that in the law. In yesterday's quick poll, we asked you this. Was the attack last week at a GOP baseball practice an act of political terrorism? 83% of you agreed with me and said yes. Just 17% of you said no to that. If you want to podcast the show, check it out on SoundCloud.com or at The Lars Larson Podcast or on iTunes. You can also follow me on Twitter at Lars Larson Show and on Facebook at The Lars Larson Show. And, of course, you're always welcome to send your emails right here. They all come directly to me. No filters, no safeguards. They all get right to me. talk@LarsLarson.com. Now, about the health care bill. Again, we're still deconstructing some of what went into it, but it would reduce the amount of money that the federal government has been pouring into health care. It would reduce the number of people who are eligible for Medicaid. But I've told you before, there's a good argument about why people should be not as generous with Medicaid, because right now we have a tremendous number of people who are signed up for Medicaid, insurance for the poor, who are able-bodied, sound of mind, don't have children that they're responsible for at home, and they're of working age. We're not talking about the elderly. We're not talking about the infirm. We're not talking about people who are mentally ill. We're talking about people who could be working. Should you and I be paying for their health insurance, or should they get up off their duffs and get a job in a generous economy right now and go out and pay for it themselves? I wanted to talk a bit about this incident in Los Angeles. It happened in the early morning hours just before 4 a.m. today. L.A. County Sheriff's deputies accidentally shot and killed a teenage boy in Palmdale. And here's how it happened. His pit bull charged at the officers. You know the dog. And I know I have friends who have pit bulls. They're not my favorite dog, I have to be honest. But if you decide to have such a dog, it's your responsibility to make sure that you don't allow that dog to attack people. What happened was the deputies had gone to a home about 3:40 in the morning in response to a call about a loud party. As they arrived, a pit bull charged at them and bit one of the deputies in the left knee. There was a memo written up about this. It says the deputy shot at the pit bull while the dog owner simultaneously tried to jump on top of the dog to stop it from attacking those sheriff's deputies. The bullet, either a ricochet or a bullet intended for that attacking dog, hit the teenager. He died later at Antelope Valley Hospital. The deputy who had been bitten by the animal was struck also by a bullet fragment. He was treated at another local hospital and is listed in stable condition. The dog was shot, but the dog survived. Now, we won't talk breed bans tonight and that sort of thing. I don't want to get into that one tonight. We can do it on another day, perhaps tomorrow, First Amendment Friday. But this is a sad circumstance, and you can probably expect that this boy's family will sue for wrongful death. But let me ask you, if you have a dog like that, a pit bull, a dog you cannot control, when the officers, the deputies, first showed up at the house, the dog rushed them. One of the deputies was bitten, and the teenager tied the dog up, but apparently did not secure the dog enough. So when the dog got loose from the rope or the chain that was holding him back, he went after the deputies again. Now, the deputies had no choice but to protect themselves by trying to shoot that dog. And yet the teenage owner decided to try to dive in front of the deputies and onto the dog to stop the dog from attacking. Again, this was a dog that was not under the control of its owner. If you decide to own a dangerous dog like that and a dog that will attack people, then you need to take responsibility for the dog. And if you can't do that, bad things may happen. This teenager, unfortunately, died at the end of that incident. I'll bet you've heard me talk about my Sleep Number bed and how well I sleep. Well, my Sleep Number is 65, and my Tina, my wife's Sleep Number, is 35. Now my friends at Sleep Number have introduced the most amazing bed ever. I'm going to get one of them. It's the new Sleep Number 360 Smart Bed, designed to keep each of you effortlessly comfortable for your best possible sleep. Like all their beds, the Sleep Number 360 smart beds let you choose your ideal firmness and support on each side of the bed, your Sleep Number setting. Now with the new responsive air technology, this bed senses your every move and automatically adjusts to you, so you stay sleeping comfortably throughout the night. Did you know that many of us fall asleep faster if our feet are just a little bit on the warm side? Well, the Sleep Number 360 can even pre-warm each side of the bed, so it's just right for both of you. Does your bed do that? Did you also know that Sleep Number beds cost about the same as a traditional mattress, and they last twice as long? Best of all, 91% of owners recommend Sleep Number. My Sleep Number setting, 65. Well, now's a great time to come in during the lowest prices of the season, when you can save $500 to $700 on the most popular 2016 beds. Visit any of the 550 Sleep Number stores nationwide. Visit sleepnumber.com to find them and tell them Lars sent you.
Connect with Lars 24/7 on Facebook and Twitter. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Pleasure to be with you, and I'll get back to your call shortly at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. From Gun Owners of America, Eric Pratt, its spokesperson, joins me now. Eric, good to have you back on the program.
Hey, thank you so much, Lars. Great to be with you.
Listen, I'm one of those people who would like to see nationwide reciprocity for concealed carry. I currently have permits for two states. I goofed and let my Arizona permit lapse, and that would have covered me for another 30 or so. But it would be nice to see the day where someone with a concealed carry permit from one state could have the same confidence of traveling to another state that someone with a driver's license from, say, California or Florida or Texas or Louisiana can travel to any other state in America and not even wonder, does my driver's license from my state cover me in another state? How close are we to getting to that goal?
Well, I think we're getting real close, Lars. We're at 200 co-sponsors now out of 3,000 bills that have been introduced in the House of Representatives. This bill, the reciprocity bill, has the 14th highest number of co-sponsors. That's really significant, especially when you consider that this is a gun bill. So it's gathered a lot of momentum. And I tell you, it's been great because when we go up on the Hill, we constantly hear from the guys on the Hill, oh, yeah. We've heard from Gun Owners of America members. You guys are loud, and you know we're getting the message. So that's very encouraging. But Lars, I agree wholeheartedly with you. You know, this is not just a theoretical discussion or just a discussion of convenience versus inconvenience. This has real life consequences. I mean, think about the Alexandria shooting last week, which happened not too far from the GOA offices. But you know that. It was awful, but the fact that it went on as long as it did, you can actually pin it on the fact that there wasn't reciprocity, because one of the congressmen who was there, Representative Loudermilk of Georgia, pointed out that, you know, normally when he's back home in Georgia, he carries, his aides carry, and he pointed out that he had aides who were near the guy, who were in their cars, but they were disarmed, whereas in Georgia, they would have been armed.
And by the way, just so people understand this, and Eric, correct me if I'm wrong, but the reason it's not, and again, this isn't just about convenience, as you said, necessity. If you work for a congressman in Washington, D.C., and D.C. does not recognize your Virginia permit, even if you rent your home or apartment in Virginia while you're working for that D.C. congressman, there's no practical way to carry, because you know, when you leave your office in D.C. and cross the bridge into Virginia, you'd have to, I guess, travel to a storage locker or travel to your home, pick up your pistol, then go wherever it was you were planning to go, and then on your way back to D.C., stop back at that storage location, drop your pistol off, because you can't cross into the district carrying a pistol. That's insane. It makes carrying a gun, and I carry every day. I'm carrying right now. It makes it a practical impossibility for people.
That's precisely the problem. You know, Georgia and Virginia, where that congressman's from and his aides are from, they have reciprocity, but you exactly outlined the problem that you can't take your firearm. You know, if they had it there at the field, then they wouldn't be able to take it with them to work. And so as a practical result, they end up not carrying. And that's really the problem. That's what H.R. 38 would fix. It would basically make it like a driver's license. You know, you're licensed to drive a car. You can anywhere in the country. It would treat being able to carry a firearm in the same way. Actually, it has the added benefit, if you're from a constitutional carry state, then you still maintain that right anywhere in the country as well. So it's a very good bill. In fact, people can go to our website at gunowners.org. We've got an alert at the top of the webpage there, and we have pre-written language where people with just a couple clicks of their mouse can send off emails to their representatives, senators, you know, whoever, encouraging them to get on this bill and encourage the leadership to bring it up for a vote.
Well, and just in anticipation of some people out there who are listening who will say, but the requirements are different in different states. I went back and researched this a couple of years ago. You know, the requirements for driver's licenses are different from state to state. Not gigantically different, But some states allow you to get a driver's license without, driving with another individual for a while. You can just go down and take the test. You get your license, and you're qualified to drive. Other driver's licenses require that you spend a period of time or a certain number of hours driving with an already licensed driver, perhaps one who's over 18 or over 21, before you can get a license. Some of them have different ages, not dramatically different, but different. They have different testing standards, driving testing, and all those other standards. And so, and yet, the license obtained perhaps in one state where the license requirements are smaller, that license still works in the other states around it and across the country. So if people are concerned about the requirements in one state being different than the requirements in another state, we've already had lots of practice with that. And to my knowledge, no gigantic problem simply because, Louisiana has a different driving standard than, say, Iowa does.
Exactly right. Same analogy with marriage. Some states, you can at 16 with permission of parents. Others say no. And yet, if you are married at 16, then every other state will recognize that. So it's the same exact thing. And that's what Article 4, the full faith and credit provision, actually protects. Congress has that power to standardize that by requiring each of the states to recognize the acts and procedures of another. So it's extremely constitutional, whether you're looking at Article 4 of our Constitution or the 14th Amendment, which, the Chicago versus McDonald case in 2010 basically said, look, the 14th Amendment applies the Second Amendment to all around the country.
All right, before we run out of time, Eric, who are these 18 or so members of Congress that we have to get on the right page on this?
Well, people can go to our website and see the listing of those who are on the bill. And therefore, you can just look at it and say, okay, well, my congressman's not on the bill. There's a few other Republicans who still haven't jumped on. There's three Democrats who are on. Probably not going to get many more Democrats. The dividing line, the gulf is huge between the two parties on this issue, more so than it's ever been. But people can find that on our fact sheets page. We have a fact sheet on H.R. 38. And again, people can take action and encourage their representative, hey, get on this bill, encourage the leadership to bring this bill up for a vote. We think we have the votes. I mean, if a bill has 200 co-sponsors, you only need 18 more people who and that's very typical. A lot of people who don't co-sponsor a bill will still vote for it when it comes before them. So we think we have the votes to pass, and that's why we're pressing the leadership. Let's bring this up and pass it.
Okay, so that's where we have the problem at this point. Is it Paul Ryan that's standing in the way, or a particular committee chair that needs to say, let's kick this out of committee and send it to the floor with a due pass recommendation?
Right. It would start in the committee, the Judiciary Committee, that would then send it to the floor. And then, of course, Paul Ryan's got to bring it up. And once we get it passed, now we're going to have a bigger challenge in the Senate. We have a majority in the Senate who support it, but we're probably one or two votes short of stopping a filibuster. But that's okay, because once a bill gets passed, it's then a lot easier to attach it to another must-pass bill. So that gives us a lot more flexibility. So it's a lot easier to do something with it once it's moving than if it just stays stationary and isn't moving along with the 3,000 other bills in the Congress.
Well, and it would be nice if they want to stage a filibuster. I'd love to have a bunch of Democrats go on record as saying they are against the Second Amendment's civil rights of American citizens. It wouldn't hurt my feelings at all if they came out and identified themselves as not favoring the civil rights of Americans. We'll remind them of that in November of next year. Eric, keep up the good work at Gun Owners of America, and thanks for your time.
Thank you, Lars. It's been a pleasure.
You bet. Glad to have you on. Coming up, legendary broadcaster and the host of Fox Business News, and now author Lou Dobbs on the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show.
Well, Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Glad to get your phone calls and your emails, and we'll get back to those in a moment at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk at LarsLarson.com. It has been way too long since I talked to my old friend Lou Dobbs. You see him on Fox Business News. You've known him from radio in past years, but I didn't know that he had a novel in him. Lou, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, Lars. It's great to talk with you. And you're right. It's been too long.
Well, and imagine this, a novel wrapped around the idea that an American is falsely accused of having connections to the Russians and becomes the center of a gigantic conspiracy. Now, knowing the turnaround time for books, you did not write this in the last 4 months, did you?
Right. It's 2 years, as you well know, in production to get to here. And little did any of us know, you know, I started writing these thrillers. This is my second one because Bob Gleason, the editor at Tor Books, asked me to do this. I thought at first it was crazy, but it turned out to be a great idea and a lot of fun.
The book is called Putin's Gambit, and no, it does not involve a politician. It actually involves a man who's in business, private business, and all of a sudden he's accused of being involved in a major transfer of money that involves the Russians. And really, I think maybe you know, this book really needs to be read by a few people, including all those people who thought that Barack Obama was right when he said to Mitt Romney that the Russians weren't really a problem for the United States when it came to being a threat.
Yeah, I think that the timing of this book, because we were laughing about it a few weeks ago, the timing could not have been more propitious. And frankly, the research that we did to get to build the thriller, all is designed to inform the American public as well as entertain them about what Russia is up to in Europe, in the Mediterranean, in the Middle East, and how significantly the threat posed by both Russia and China remain despite the end of the Cold War some 20 years on from that point.
Lou, do you think you've got some good idea of what it is they are up to? Because it seems to me that their main goal seems to be create chaos for the rest of the world, and that somehow chaos is going to keep the Russian people's attention off of Russia's own problems and Vladimir Putin's failings of that country, and keep the United States rocked back on its heels if it possibly can.
Well, all of that is certainly being done and being done at the direction of Vladimir Putin. But at the same time, I truly believe that the U.S. Foreign policy has just been awkward throughout the last since 1991. We had an opportunity to build bridges, to build great partnerships with Russia, and chose instead to ignore them. And there are 1,700 deployed warheads, and that wasn't a very clever step on our part. And now we're having to deal with all that has ensued. So. To me, it's pretty clear that he, being Vladimir Putin, really means to create again the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, but in his image, empire in the image of Vladimir Putin, excuse me, whether it be the Mediterranean, whether it be North Africa, whether it be the Middle East or Europe itself. Europe is the prize, and I think that Vladimir Putin has made it very clear that's exactly where he's headed.
Lou Dobbs is my guest. He's the author most recently of a novel, and this is your first novel, isn't it? You haven't written any other nonfiction books, have you, or fiction books, have you?
Yeah, I wrote a book 2 years ago called Border Wars on the state of our southern border, and it was a hoot as well, and also. It anticipated the arrival of someone very much like Donald Trump.
Well, and in fact, what I wonder about is you and I both spend most of our time dealing with the, you know, the nonfiction world. We deal with the factual world. Is it more fun to be able to go out and do some things where it doesn't have to stick exactly to the facts of the real world when you write it?
Well, what's that? You know, it is fun. More fun, I don't know, because these issues that you and I get, we have the privilege of dealing with every day. I don't think I would say more fun, but it is certainly different. It's illuminating, and we reach an audience with a thriller like Putin's Gambit, that we wouldn't normally reach through our nonfiction efforts, if you will, whether in the news business or talk radio. It's just a different way to get to a different and larger audience.
Hey, Lou, since I've got your ear right now, I want to get your take on this. How long can both the Democrat Party and the news media push along this, we have to investigate Russia and its alleged connections to the Trump administration, when after 12 months now, I mean, if you date it back to June of last year, when the FBI says it first began looking at it, they haven't found anything at all. Nothing.
You're absolutely right. And they will push it as long as President Trump permits them and Attorney General Sessions permits them. When you hear that the U.S. Justice Department has opened an investigation into James Comey, when you hear that they've opened an investigation into Loretta Lynch and former President Bill Clinton and their discussions on the tarmac in Phoenix, when you hear that the Clinton Foundation is now under investigation, that is Hillary Clinton under investigation for both that and her email servers and the Uranium One decision that cost us 20% of our uranium assets, then you will know that the collusion part is over. And now that we will have turned, if you will, from fiction to nonfiction.
You know, that last part about Uranium One, that I think is the most troubling one to me, because it seems like the lowest hanging fruit they could go after, to say, was there a tie between the $30 million donation given to the Clinton Foundation by a man, a Canadian, who helped engineer the deal that right. left Russia owning 20% of our uranium reserves? That one seems like something that a junior grade prosecutor in the Manhattan U.S. Attorney's Office could put together in about an afternoon. Let's see. The Russians ended up with the uranium. This guy made $300 million. He kicked a 10% bonus over to Hillary. Hillary signed off on the deal, without which the deal could not have happened because she was Secretary of State at the time. The quid pro quo there doesn't seem to take a rocket scientist to figure out.
Right. And Bill Clinton got a $500,000 speaking fee. Shortly thereafter.
But you don't expect at all that any of the investigation is going to go in that direction, do you?
No, I do. I actually do. Because otherwise, what would be the point of having Jeff Sessions as Attorney General? What would be the point of having an administration that means to enforce law and order? You can't have law and order if you give a pass to Hillary Clinton and the Clinton criminal enterprise. It just can't be done.
Well, I got to tell you, Lou, every time that Robert Mueller picks up another ex-Clinton Foundation lawyer to add to his team, I start to lose hope that we're actually going to find out what really went on.
If Robert Mueller is still there in 30 days, then we do have dark days upon us. He either has to recuse himself and resign the special counsel, or be fired by the president, because he's contemptuous of law, contemptuous of the very appearance of conflicts of interest that are prohibited by the special counsel statute itself. This is rank and raw corruption and conflict of interest, and it's got to stop. And if it doesn't stop here, it never will.
His most recent novel is called Putin's Gambit. He is Lou Dobbs from Fox News Business. Lou, it's a pleasure to have you back on the program. Thanks so much for the time.
Thank you, and it's great to talk with you, and I look forward to talk to you soon. And join me on my show, if you will.
I will do that one of these days. Thank you so very much. That's Lou Dobbs with us. Back in just a moment, folks. You've got the Lars Larson Show. Portland's best traffic is right here from Brett Recamp on FM News 101 KXL.
Honestly provocative talk at LarsLarson.com.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It is a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to take your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk at LarsLarson.com. And we all saw the reaction of the left-wingers and the greenies and the folks who talk about the environment all day long right before they jump on their private jet to jet off to a global warming conference. The reaction they had to President Donald Trump saying, we are getting out of the Paris Climate Accord, which is really a treaty that should have been voted on by the Senate, and I'm confident would have been voted down by the Senate, but we're out of it. And the reaction to that was a lot of major cities said, we're going to go ahead and do it on our own anyway. We're going to have our own little city or county or state Paris Accord that we're going to have, even though cities and counties and states aren't supposed to engage in foreign policy. And I thought I'd get Todd Myers on, who's the environmental director for the Washington Policy Center, to talk about how it usually works out when you see mayors and governors and the like come out and make these bold promises about what they're going to do on their own, no matter what the federal government does with something like the Paris Climate Accord. Todd, welcome back.
Yeah, thanks for having me. So, yeah, when President Trump pulled out of the Paris Climate Accord, so, for example, Mayor Rahm Emanuel of Chicago put out an executive order saying that Chicago would meet the targets of the Paris Climate Accord and joined a number of other cities doing that. The interesting thing about it is that Chicago already had some targets for 2020, and according to their own report, they were going to miss their own targets for 2020 by 62%. So the irony is that here they're making a very big show about what they're going to do and trying to upstage President Trump, even as they're not meeting the current targets that they set for themselves.
But do you think that they realize that most of the folks out there, other than folks like you, they're not going to get called on this by their local media who could go back? I mean, the Chicago media could go to Rahm Emanuel. The Seattle media could go to the current mayor, Mayor Murray, who has his own problems these days. And they could say, so how are you doing on those goals you set a couple of years ago? Except for some reason, I don't see a great, I don't see a great willingness on the part of those local media to go and challenge their local elected officials on whether or not they actually fulfill these promises.
And there's a very funny story about that, which is that, you know, previously there was the Kyoto Protocol, which the Clinton administration actually also didn't put before Senate because they knew it would be voted down. But when George Bush said, well, we're not going to follow the Kyoto Protocol, President Bush, a number of cities led by Seattle's mayor, Greg Nickels, said, oh, well, we'll meet the Kyoto targets then. So when 2012 came around, I called the 30-something cities that were in Washington State and said, how are you doing on meeting the promises that you made because you signed this agreement? And two-thirds of them said, we don't know what you're talking about. We've never heard this before. So they had forgotten about it completely. So it's not just the media that forgets about it. It's the cities themselves that forget about it. The irony was is that in 2014, when Seattle actually released its data and said, okay, we did miss the Kyoto targets, I told several members of the media this. And they said, well, that's clearly not true. You don't know what you're talking about. Show me your data. And I said, well, it's the city's own report. And reporters wouldn't write about it. Finally, to his credit, one Seattle Times reporter did say, okay, well, we've missed the targets. But then what the politicians do is, well, that's the past. Next time, though, we're going to meet them. And that's what a lot of them are doing this time as well, is, yes, we failed every time this far, but this time will be different.
Well, and in fact, they missed it badly because the promise in 2005 by the Seattle mayor, the then mayor, Greg Nickels, was that they would cut carbon dioxide to 7% below 1990 levels. So they did that 15 years after 1990. They said in 7 years, by 2012, we'll cut it to 7% below. Well, they actually did cut it by what? 1%, not 7%.
Right.
So they fell short by about 80%, didn't they? 75%?
Well, absolutely. Yeah, and absolutely. And what's worse about that is that they got the benefit, if you can call it that, of the economic downturn. So most of those emissions reductions had nothing to do with public policy. It had to do with the economic downturn. Well, the only way that they can continue to meet those reductions or meet the new targets is to have more economic downturns because the policies are not working and they're off track for their current targets. So again, the reason I tell these stories is one is to say that the left claims to have a monopoly on and, you know, care about the environment. But if they actually cared about the environment, they would hold themselves accountable for failure. And the fact that they care more about the publicity and the press releases than they do about the environment shows that their commitment is really insincere.
Well, and an awful lot of the improvement that's been happening anyway, Todd, correct me if I'm wrong, comes because American industry has a financial incentive to reduce the amount of energy they have to use to earn a dollar. So if they can do that, they reduce CO2 automatically. We have newer cars that are coming on the roads all the time because the average age of a car is 13 years. So when you get to, say, 2020, the average car. The average car will be a car manufactured by in 2005 or 2006. So they'll all be relatively newer cars with much better pollution numbers and much better efficiency ratings than they would have anyway, no matter what the cities do.
That's exactly right. Homes are more efficient today because people don't want to spend money on gas and electric. The Prius wasn't a government car, right? The Prius was not created by government. In fact, politicians didn't know what a hybrid vehicle was when Toyota and Honda created hybrid vehicles. The best ideas come out of the free market because the free market is unrelenting in the drive to do more with less. That not only makes us more prosperous, it means we use less overall in terms of resources, electricity, water, everything else. That's where the benefits have come from. And with regard to improving the use of electricity, you're exactly right. That's where the savings have come from, not from public policy.
Well, what seems odd about this, Todd, you know, I've been a reporter for a long time. Reporters love numbers, and they love to be able to say, well, what are you promising to do, and what have you done in the past? That's a standard set of questions to ask somebody. If a private company came out, if Boeing said, we're going to produce twice as many jets next year as we did last year, and they missed that number, the media would be happy to remind folks, you know, they said they were going to double jet production, and they only increased it by 70%. But when it comes to politicians, they seem unwilling to do it, even though it sounds like a great story to me, to some politician who's holding a news conference saying, we're going to meet the Paris Climate Accord, say, how'd you do on Kyoto? Didn't you miss that one by a mile? And if you missed on the last one, why should anybody expect that you're gonna actually hit the target this time?
Well, and in fact, corporations are legally required to report their financial and other data like that if they don't meet their targets, and shareholders can literally sue them over things like that, over misrepresentations. Politicians, as you point out, they're not held accountable. What they say is, well, we're held accountable at the ballot box.
Todd, it is a real pleasure to have you back on the program. Thanks so much and for taking the time today.
It's always fun to talk with you.
Todd Myers, who's the Environmental Director for the Washington Policy Center. We'll be back in a moment with your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@larslarson.com.